about time for us to get started. And welcome. My name is Kevin Thornton. If you don't know who I am a sub today, so bear with us as we go through our lesson this morning. Just getting wired up is difficult enough to be able to get through this. So I'm Kevin Thornton. Kevin. Or I go by hey you or whoever. I'm not proud, so certainly can go with that. Today I thought it would be, today's Father's Day. Wish everyone a happy Father's Day for us to be able to begin. As we look to get into our lesson is going to be looking at Jeremiah. It's this continuation of their study for Jeremiah. But before we do that, as we're waiting for anyone, latecomers to come in, what's a memorable Father's Day that you had? You had a memorable Father's Day that stands out? What was it that caused you to have that memorable Father's Day experience? Your twins were born. Were that your first child, first children?
Oh, no.
No? Just the joy of having twins.
Well, I had three sets, but...
Oh, Lord. Bless you.
that's
Wow. I don't know if I could have handled that. Anybody else have a memorable Father's Day? We don't get served breakfast in bed, so that's not a memorable Father's Day experience. Gotcha.
I used to be at the Bible camp when I started this week. My family would always just take off. I'd be here.
You get left. That's a tough sell. Yes. Well, Father's Day sometimes gets left behind, but every morning, for us, it's being greeted in bed, jumped on in that early hours of the morning to be able to say Happy Father's Day. So they want to get that out the first thing. So they can't wait to get there. As another side note, I thought, I have somebody in my office that loves to Google everything. So she's the Google queen in our office. And, I asked her about, what's memorable of Father's Day. So she actually went on Google and found the 10 worst Father's Day gifts that are out there. And I just thought that was kind of funny with, as we lead into Father's Day. So I was only able to share five of those because the other five were not really church related or appropriate. So I had to tailor that list down a little bit. But there's a Yankee Candles made a bacon smelling candle, which I just find bizarre that that's what they would do. But that was one of the worst Father's Day gifts that they had out there. How about a shouting vase? This retails for $55 for you to buy a shouting vase for a Father's Day gift. I know that there's times that I could probably use that vase, but I guess I need to buffle it in my own hand. And this one, for those that have less hair, those that have... I thought that was quite funny that they had little stickers you can put on the top of your forehead for tattoos and to be able to do that. I know I've got a visitor here that... Sorry. Yes, I did. Let's just say yes, I did. And this one, I thought, the maggings, the leggings for men. I would not want that as a Father's Day gift. I thought that was very funny also. And then the last one is the Lou Reader. So, just some things there that you wouldn't want to really get for Father's Day. But Happy Father's Day. It is a time to celebrate a fathers and for the contribution that they do. And being able to guide, direct, and lead the family and being able to do that. If you want to take your Bibles, we're looking at Jeremiah 39 is where our text is going to be this morning and being able to look at that passage. If you're visiting with us, we've been looking at Jeremiah for the last several weeks. Jeremiah the prophet and being able to foretell what's going to happen and to be able to lead Jerusalem at this point in time. Our title of our lesson is The Fall of Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is falling at this point in time and being able to look at that. But before we do that, let's look at get the context of where we're going and how we're going to get where we're going to be looking at the text this morning. Back in Jeremiah 25, we read, this whole country will become a desolate wasteland, and these nations will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Jeremiah is predicting that Babylon's going to fall. So he's talking with the king there and being able to share with him about the fall of Babylon, to fall to Babylon within this time frame. So this is his prediction, this is his foresight, and being able to look at that piece. if you think about that, you know, Jeremiah's probably, not Jeremiah, but the king Zedekiah is probably thinking, we're in a fortified land. There's no way we're going to be being under attack and that we need to fall to Babylon. So, you know, we need to be thinking about Jerusalem sitting on the hillside, up on the mountain, well fortified, wall all the way around it, to be able to really really hone in on the text there. So I'm sure King Zedekiah is thinking, you're crazy. Why would we want to do that? Why would we want to surrender to Babylon and being able to look at that piece? If you look at the map here, I don't know how well you can read this. It looked better on my computer in front of me. So on the lower section here is where they're going to be looking at the king's garden. That's where they're going to be looking. This really just really illustrates us to be able to see that there is a wall that goes all the way around the city to be able to be the protection for this time. So I'm sure King Zedekiah is thinking, you know, there's no reason for us to be able to not withstand the battle. We also, in Jeremiah 27 and 14, we're going to read that, you know, his noblemen, his people that provide counsel to the king Zedekiah, is telling him that there's no way that that's going to happen. We can see in Jeremiah 27, 14, do not listen to the words of the prophets who say, you will not serve the king of Babylon, for they are prophesying lies to you. So we're able to see here that, you know, that he's getting that mixed message. Who is he going to listen to? Jeremiah the prophet? Or is he going to listen to his advisors in being able to lead him into that other side of thinking about where he can withhold and withstand the attack that's going to be coming on to the city? So we're able to see that, you know, Jeremiah's come back to him twice at this point in time. In Jeremiah 38 and 18, we are able to read, but if you want to surrender to the officers of the king of Babylon, the city will be given to the hands of to the Babylonians, and they will be burnt down, and yourselves will not escape from them. Here we can see that Jeremiah has a choice. What are the two choices? Anybody see the two choices? Zedekiah, I'm sorry. Zedekiah has two choices to make. Sorry. Thank you.
Listen to the word of God or listen to men.
Listen to the word of God or listen to the word of men to be able to really hone in on that. So he has a choice to make to be able to decide on what and where they want to be leading to. Chuck?
The other part is they're thinking an attack, and Nebuchadnezzar's going to lay siege. I mean, he's going to starve them out, and he can do that. He can do that quite well.
Yes. It's going to be the starvation. We'll get right there. You're just ahead of me real quick there, but yes, we'll see what the reasons what happened and the length of time that it takes for them to go under siege. And it is that time frame, but you know that he has that choice to be able to make. And which way is he, and who is he going to listen to? You would think that he would be listening to the man of God, Jeremiah, but we'll see that he is faulting to the side. Chuck?
Well, some of the things that I had read was Zedekiah, he was also, he's worried for his life, because there was some very powerful influences in Jerusalem that would probably think about killing Zedekiah, putting someone else in there if he didn't do what they wanted to do. Because they had something to lose. So it was a political decision. It was a fear for his life. And this is the fourth king in a row after Josiah that's not following after God.
Right.
And so it's kind of embedded now in the way that they look at things, is to say, yeah, there's this God of gods all out there that I don't know that much about, but boy, I'm still worshiping Baal. I'm still worshiping Asheroth and everything else. And he's not used to depending on God. He's used to depending on himself and what they can do. And it's a situation we get ourselves in. We get abstracted away from God and say, I still recognize God, but I'll handle this myself.
Right. He's over there, and we're not seeing him as in the present and being able to see past what it is or where we're headed and being able to determine which is the best path. You know, it is interesting that, you know, the three kings that were behind him did not follow God either. Those are the elements there that has led us to where we are. And that to have that godly direction isn't the path that of the past kings or the kingship that has led its ground. So definitely the two choices that he has to make, to surrender and live, or to go into battle and lose, and then he'll eventually lose his life. All right. I'm apologizing now. There's many names in here that I can't not pronounce. So, you know, if you feel that I'm not doing it justice, I understand, and I'll be more than happy to let you read the passage if that's the case. So, you know, we're going to jump right on into the end of Zedekiah. In chapter 39, verses 1 through 7 is our text this morning. We'll be breaking it up into sections for us to be able to study. Starting with verse 1, in the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, marched against Jerusalem with the whole army and laid siege to it. And on the ninth day of the 4th month, Zedekiah's 11th year, the city wall was broken through. And then all the officials of the king of Babylon came and took seats in the middle gate. Nergal Shalzar of Samgar, Nibiru Sergim, a chief officer, Nergal Shalzar, a high official, and all the other officials of the king of Babylon. Then, when I lost the name of Zedekiah, king of Judah, and all the soldiers saw them, they fled and left the city at night in the way of the king's garden through the gate between the two walls and headed toward Abath. And the Babylon army pursued them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. They captured him and took him to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, at Rahab, and in the land of Hamath, where they pronounced sentence on him. There at Rahab, the king of Babylon slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before the eyes, and also killed the nobles of Judah. Then he put out Zedekiah's eye and bound them with bronze shackles to take him to Babylon. Not a pretty picture that's taking place here. You know, the warfare has started. The fight has begun. And there's not a whole lot of rest at this point in time. So he's been warned, and now we're going into battle to be able to fight them off at this point in time. How long did the battle last? Can y'all figure it out by the ninth month of the 10th day of the... Anybody? I think I do. Oh, I need to catch up. Thank you, Chuck. I'm on a roll.
2 years.
About 2 years. A year and a half, 18 months is what they've been able to say they held them off. So about a year and a half time frame that took place here to be able to look at that, to be able to really fight that battle and be able to make sure that that's going on. In Jeremiah 52 and 6, it says, by the ninth day in the 4th month, the famine of the city had become so severe that there was no food in the city to eat. This goes back to Chuck's point is, it really wasn't a warfare battle that was going on. Yes, there was some fighting going on there, but is what was happening inside the city, is where they were being starved, plagues, you know, different people's sickness. You know, they couldn't open the gate anymore to get out, to be able to go out and do or gather things. At this point in time, they were under siege, but it was more of a warfare battle where it is starting starvation and they start turning themselves against each other. If you think about the year and a half that took place, this started in what month? Fourth month that it started. So it started, there's a long, long period of time there that they were going on and fighting off the battle with regards to starvation and other things that are going on there. So very interesting that it's not necessarily a battle of bows, arrows, fights, and, you know, those types of things. It's more of a battle within that's taking place in the city. Let's see, I need to catch up myself. What did King Zedekiah and the close advisors do when they realized the city wall has been breached?
Got out of Dodge.
They hit head for the hills, wouldn't they? They weren't sticking around to see what was going on, to be able to see what would be left. You know, you would think the king would stay there, would continue to fight. But when did they leave? Was it at night? It wasn't in the day of the light, where people could see them exiting out. They scrambled at night to be able to get out of the city, to be able to escape. Where was Zedekiah when the Babylonians came and overtook them? Where was Zedekiah? There we go. Catch up. Sorry, newbie. Sub.
Plains of Jericho?
He was headed for the plains of Jericho. He's out running at that point in time. So they were trying to escape, getting out of there to be able to not withstand the battle or get caught. I mean, they were truly running for their life at this point in time to be able to look at that piece. What did Zedekiah was made to watch when he was captured? Killed his family. And who else?
Well, he killed the nobles.
His nobles.
But his sons.
His sons were there too, as part of his family.
The last thing he was going to see was the death of his sons.
Correct. You know, you think about that piece of it, that's the last thing he sees. Now he's captured, and we'll see later where he's taken off the prison to be able to, you know, to endure the, plucking of his eyes or being killed off or dying off at that point in time. But, you know, that last thing that he sees is killing of his sons, his noblemen, and his advisors that led him down this path to be able to that path of destruction. That's not a real pretty picture to be left with. I mean, when you think about losing your sight, you know, you want to think about the beauty of the world, not necessarily the challenges of seeing defeat in battle, to be able to really drive that home. This here is just another depiction. If you look at the right-hand corner down at the left is where they escaped and headed to Jericho and being able to escape Jerusalem at this point in time. You know, when you leave at night, you know, as you leave in the depth of night, where the darkness of night, you know, they're not leaving to be seen by anybody out that's leaving out. So, you know, that their whole intent was is to escape and get out without anybody seeing them and to be able to run for their lives at this point in time.
Hey, Kev.
Yes, sir.
But the way they approached it wasn't a good idea. It just kind of shows they don't think things through. You don't leave with a crowd to go through enemy lines to escape. You do with as few as people as you can. And he went with him, his sons, his family, his nobles, all in his big group in the middle of the night. And Nebuchadnezzar has the city surrounded. It's like, we noticed.
Yeah, we knew you left with the band going out of the city. They knew that they were being pursued to that regard. You know, if you're going to escape, you would think you would leave with maybe you and your sons and being able to leave out of the city. But that was not how they left. They left with the counterband and being able to go out. And you're right. I don't know why he thought he could get through the line with Nebuchadnezzar's battle or his army there with regards to being able to surround the city. But he thought he could. And, you know, and it may have been where he thought... And again, this is just Kevin thinking, you know, out loud here, is that I'm either going to die inside the city or I'm going to die outside and trying to escape and playing that odds to be able to really maybe see where he could get to. All right. Here we see in Jeremiah 52:11, we find out what happens to Jeremiah, to the king, that he's bound with bronze shackles. He's taken to Babylon, where he's put in prison until the day of his death. You know, prison back then isn't as nice as what we know it today. So I can only imagine what the surroundings or the settings were for him in being able to be put in prison, especially with his eyes plucked out or gouged out or however you want to be able to describe that. And certainly modern medicine wasn't in place at that point in time to help, you know, help him heal, because I'm sure that wasn't the intent of them doing what they did to him. So he did get taken off to prison, where he eventually dies in prison. And again, it's not one of those deaths that you necessarily would want to endure to be able to get that through. All right, that takes us to Jeremiah 39:8-10. We see the end of Jerusalem. The Babylonians set fire to the royal palace and the houses of the people and broke down the walls of Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar, commander of the imperial guard, carried into exile the Babylonian, the people who remained in the city, along with those who had gone over to him, and the rest of the people. But Nebuchadnezzar, the commander of the guard, left behind in the land of Judah some of the poor people who owned nothing, but at that time gave them vineyards and fields. Why do you think that they left people behind?
They weren't useful.
Okay. I'm sure they took all the people they could probably put into slavery.
Somebody who could contribute, but someone who may have been more trouble than they were worth, they just leave behind.
What's that?
So the same reason we had the people show up on the shore of the border and start setting the Cuba. They're more of, like Chuck said, a burden.
Correct. They're more of a burden. It could be where they're not useful. They could be, you know, past their prime to be able to, you know, farm fields, things that they would be able to put them to work or to be sold into slavery. So, you know, definitely that they're looking for those that that would remain to be able to help in that regard. You know, there's just that ability to be able to, you know, pick and choose. I guess there are so many. Susan? Exactly. That's one of the other reasons, you know, looking at that piece of it is that legacy that's left behind. You know, certainly that is a reminder of what transpired, because, you know, we're going to find out they didn't leave anything. They knocked the walls down. They've left a desolated area to be able to where it was a fortified city sitting on a hill. So, you know, with them having that message or that next generation being shared with what Nebuchadnezzar had did to them, certainly that has value in leaving people behind. And even giving them vineyards or land allows them to take that ownership piece of it where they're resonating or getting engaged in that piece. So there's definitely value of leaving people behind in the warfare to really fight off that battle. Any other comments? All right. In Jeremiah 39:11-14, I need to catch up again, sorry. We read that, "Now Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylon, had given these orders about Jeremiah through Nebuchadnezzar and commander and the imperial guard. Take heed and look after him. Don't harm him, but do for him whatever he asks. So Nebuchadnezzar and the commander of the guard, Beshan, the chief officer, Nelgar Shalzar, the high official, and all the other officers of the king of Babylon, sent and had Jeremiah taken out of the courtyard of the guard. They turned him over to the Galgenians, son of the Almakak, the son of the Saphon, to take him back to the home. So he remained among the people, remained among his own people." So what happened there? No.
You just qualified yourself to be an elder the way you butchered all
that. I apologize early.
because he evidently got the word that Jeremiah had been saying, if you surrender, you'll be treated well, and Jerusalem won't be burnt to the ground. So his advice all along has been consistent with what Nebuchadnezzar was going to do.
What I find interesting, you know, his knowledge of Jeremiah, and his ability to, you know, he knew ahead of time that they're going to protect him. And, you know, you wouldn't think that would be the case with regards to the battle lines being drawn. You know, you're wiping out the city. You think about the fall of Jerusalem. It's the battle line that's drawn, but you're going to single out one individual that you are pulling forward.
There was a connection between Nebuchadnezzar and God. Nebuchadnezzar and God. We don't know that much about it. We know when Nebuchadnezzar went and stuck his foot in his mouth, that it cost him for a while. When he said, look at all the things I've done, he turned into basically almost a beast until he recognized that it was through God he had gotten everything. But there was some relationship. He understood who the God of heaven was. And he understood this man was of that God of heaven. And there was a lot of respect, I think, for someone, because he had that respect for Daniel as well. And that may have been part of it. We're not told anything, but I'm guessing.
Well, and it could be also the fear factor of knowing of him, the direction that he provided, the guidance that he provided, and not necessarily knowing that, you know, they may have not known that, you know, they didn't heed those words, but, you know, they certainly saw value in that peace and wanted to surround him and protect him. You know, that's the message here is, you know, he saw that and he's protecting that. And like you said, I don't know what the connection is, but there's some type of connection for you to single out that person and say, hey, don't touch him. Do what he says. Listen to him.
Which is why he could have went to Gedaliah. Gedaliah is who he's going to appoint as the governor of what's left. And he's taken Jeremiah and said, here, Gedaliah. The last guy didn't listen to this guy. You see what happened. You need to listen to this guy. You're my governor. But you need to listen to Jeremiah.
Right.
This is probably the third way. Probably a third wave of Babylonian captivity and invasion. Like you say, just learn something that first two waves, the best, brightest, the most wonderful, the best future for times. Just learn them. I think even like that, the neighbors know that's God's country, and they've over the centuries they've tried to attack it, they've done different things, and not really been all that successful. But yeah, Chuck, I'm with Chuck. He knows God. Some way, somehow, gives him credit for that.
And this is a big deal. I mean, the battle of taking out Jerusalem, it's a very big deal that that's taking place. You know, that's something that, you know, that was unheard of with regards to the fortified city that it was sitting on, the fortified city on sitting on the hill. So, you know, the battle in itself, them winning the battle, either seeing, you know, Jeremiah as that resource to be able to drive that piece home. I think that's an important lesson for us. But, you know, looking at that and understanding the value of that, and understanding, you know, don't touch him, don't harm him, keep him safe, listen to him, and being able to really drive that piece home. And looking at lessons for us, you know, we want to try to find ways of being able to bring this back home, this lesson for us today. You know, we can see that the trustworthy nature of God's promises, you know, that's what is evident in being able to be seen in this passage, that, you know, it affirms the trustworthiness of God under the natures of God's promises, the promises that we have that are found in God for us to be able to follow. You know, we talk about it being a choice, you know, it really was a choice for, you know, King Zedekiah and his warning to be able to be either listen or not, and to his demise to be able to be put to death. So, you know, there is a result there, the rebellions against Babylon, yet he chose the path of destruction that led him to where he is today. But looking at more for us, Chuck?
The contrast is the wisdom of the world versus the wisdom of God really is a classic example of what happened with Zedekiah was the wisdom of the nobles and everybody else was, you know, the Babylonians were cruel, vicious by most people's standards. And the wisdom of the world says, resist, resist, resist as long as you can because they're going to kill you.
Right.
The wisdom of God was capitulate and you'll live. And those two were just diametrically opposed. You had two vastly different views of what needed to be done, but Jeremiah says, if you resist, you're going to die. If you give up, you're going to be treated well. And the city will stand.
Right.
And he says, that's not wisdom. He chose the wisdom of the world.
And that still applies to us today. You know, that's where I want to go with, you know, our choices that we have today that we make. You know, if we think about lessons from the Bible, going all the way back to Adam and Eve, they had a choice to either eat of the tree of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, to be able to not to do that. So, you know, there are choices that we can see throughout the Bible, but it goes back to Chuck's point with, you know, we have choices today. The world tugs on our coat strings to be able to, you know, pull us in that direction where we've got to withstand those temptations to be able to hold fast. What are some of the other examples in the Bible that we can learn from that had the choice?
Abraham and Sarah, when he went down to Egypt, he said, she's my sister.
Right.
Instead of, well, it's half truth, but to avoid what he thought would happen to him and not trusting in God, created a situation where the Pharaoh got punished by God. And he said, why'd you do this to me? Why'd you tell me you were his sister when it was your wife? And the person who paid for it was Pharaoh. It wasn't Abraham, but it was, I think it was Abram at that time. But Abram and Sarai did not totally trust in the Lord. Now they were still learning, as we're still learning about God. But that was a choice they made, and it was a bad choice.
Good. Other choice. Other examples of the Bible.
Follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. They already knew how to be fishermen. It worked so well. It worked out well that far. It was a decision. Which way do you go?
When Moses went back to Egypt, that was a good choice. And not all of them were bad choices. That was a good choice. He could choose to say, God, no, I'm not going. I'm not going back to Egypt. They'll kill me. I'm not going to do it. But he did. He trusted in God.
No, that's a good example there, but also you go on into his journey too, where he was told to either speak to the rock or hit the rock to get water. He chose not to do that, and there was a penalty that cost him not going into Canaan. So, you know, there, and that's life. I mean, we have choices to make throughout our life that lead us down that path one way or the other.
One of David's servants that were with him and all said, look, let's just go over here and kill this guy. How dare he throw rocks at the king? And David said, no. You know, he said, if God is behind this, then I'm just going to take it. You know, I screwed up. I messed up. This is my problem. I'm not going to take vengeance out on this guy because God is, you know. I found that to be a very honorable and manly thing. You know, he was taking the abuse from this guy who he easily could have had killed without repercussions, but he didn't. He chose to just take it and say, you know, hey, if the Lord is you know, behind this and that's the way he feels that I need to be treated, then so be it. I'm gonna take it. And so I always found that a very bold choice. You know, David accepted what he had done, and he accepted that, hey, maybe this might be just God's way of punishing me. And it was a choice he made, and that was a real powerful.
Good.
I think David's life is a whole bunch of situations, if you look at the good and bad decisions, but yet he still is a man after God's own heart. And he paid a big price for some of his wrong decisions, but he paid a good price for some of the good decisions. But I mean, I can relate to him because that's the way we are in life.
Going back to the calling of the apostles, I mean, that, you know, calling them out, you know, you think about Peter, right alongside Peter, you know, I'm going to deny you three times. You know, but you still do it. The worldly side of it had kicked in enough to, you know, it happened. And, you know, thinking of the choice that was made there, too, is another one that I thought about you had with regards to, you know, driving that piece home, is that he still did it. And Judas would be the same thing. Judas Iscariot, that denied Christ or turned Christ over with the selling of 30 pieces of silver. Those types of things are choices that we all have to make in being able to choose right or wrong in that regard. Anybody else have any examples?
Some of the people that were at the trial, we interviewed them, and Jesus into Jerusalem, were also the same ones that yelled crucify. Big Pilate, who found nothing wrong with Jesus, but he had a choice. What do I do with this? He had a big choice. He even offered the crowd a choice. Release Barabbas or release Christ. Jesus, which do you want? The crowd had that choice. The
crowd wanted Christ.
He wanted to do what was politically correct.
Sure.
Yeah. And we have those same choices that we're tempted with on a daily basis. Going back to what Chuck was talking about earlier is, you know, that physical where we are today, you know, that has ability to sway us one side or the other in being able to do that. We can choose eternal life or destruction. Those are the two lessons that we need to ensure that we know as we're going out into the world, that, you know, there is a choice of choosing Christ or the way of the world.
Yeah, I think... kind of take it back to the lesson. Jeremiah had a choice to just shut up or keep telling the truth of what needed to be, because it was his heart was after God. Zedekiah's heart was not after God. And you look at 1 Corinthians 13, it's all about the heart. It's all about what you love, who you love. Do you love yourself or do you love God? If you love God, you're going to pursue those things that please God. Those worldly pressures aren't going to be as hard. They're going to be there, but not going to be as hard. But if you don't love God, you're not going to pursue what he wants you to do. Why should you? You don't love God.
Now, the drive, the desire to please God isn't there. You know, certainly that comes into play with our lives today, is that heart, that tenderness of that heart, of being able to know right from wrong and to be able to discern from which way to go. You know, in the world today, we're pulled in many, many different directions. You know, working out in the world, working with worldly people, just the interaction of people in the world. You see so much destruction, so much trouble out there in the world today that, you know, causes people that strive to be able to choose to do wrong. And, You know, it just seems like more and more in this world in which we live that we're choosing the wrong side than we are the other side. And, you know, it's
good. Older.
Is that what it is, Hank? I'm not getting older.
50 years ago, when I was younger than you, we had the same distractions. I grew up during a world war.
Mm-hmm.
We're not in a world war.
No. No, it's just other stuff that clouds our vision, clouds our eyes. And, you know, that's the stuff we got to be able to set aside. You know, that's why it's so important to be engaged in church. That's why it's important to be in Bible class. That's why it's so important to be here with one another, to gain strength from one another when we start wavering. And, you know, when sometimes our choice ability isn't where it needs to be, and being able to drive that point home. So, you know, those are the things we need to be able to look for. And we know we want to look for that reward in heaven. That's our goal. That's our effort. That's where we should be pushing. That's where our attention needs to be. And that's where we need to be focusing all our efforts, is to obtaining that reward. And, you know, and that is a choice for us to be able to choose from. Anybody else have any comments?
Being here with other Christians is so vital because it helps you.
Amen.
You know, resist some of those worldly pressures that push you in a certain direction. If you're not here, it's hard to withstand that. It really is. I mean, that's the point behind getting together, is to partly just straighten each other out when we need to, but also strengthen each other and help.
Yeah.
It helps say I'm not alone in this world in the way that I'm trying to live it.
Midweek Bible study isn't a key thing for, you know, breaking away from the grind. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, is very, very important in our way and in our walk, to ensure that sometimes that's that extra oomph to get you over the rest of the week. So, you know, I think it's important that, you know, certainly the value of us being together, us coming together, us encouraging one another, even though you may not get anything out of it, you may be encouraging somebody else that's here sitting next side of you that may need that encouragement. So us getting together, us coming together, is so vital to the body here and for us to be able to encourage one another.
It's not only the fellowship in midweek, but the encouragement to study.
Yeah. You can't leave out study. Definitely can't leave out study. The word's there for us to study. But, you know, the encouragement of us being together, too. Because there's value in the study, but there's also value in us learning from one another. What you may be able to bring to the text may be something different than what Kurt brings to the text, to be able to come together to a further knowledge. So there's value in it all. You know, there's no reason that I don't want to say one or the other. It's the value of coming together and study, singing, all the components of worship. Anybody else have any comments for the good? I appreciate you being here this morning. Appreciate you talking and speaking in class and the encouragement to me. Again, sub. Have a great week.
Thanks.
You can go into worship. Thanks. Thanks.
How you doing, Bill? Thank you. We can book out. We got in there. Sunday night, and we stayed till Thursday. Stayed through Thursday night. Yesterday, went over to the Space Center, but we were over at Universal Studio, and so the shooting away from us. All we see is a little on the news.